Thanks, Pete. Man, I'm afraid of this thing, I'll tell you. My name is A.J. McLaughlin, and I'm a very, very grateful member of the Fellowship of Al-Anon. My home group is the Sunday Night Chively Group in Louisville, Kentucky. And it's a great home group. If you're ever there, we'd be glad to have you come join us. I want to thank the committee for allowing me to share with you all. This has been a really great conference. A lot of hard work went into it, I can tell that. I want to thank Stephanie and Jenny and Deb and Pete and Jen. It was really great. I came in on the Atlanta in the air, and here was all these lovely young people meeting me. You know, it was really great. When you get around my age, you don't want to be around old people too damn much. You know, it's a lot better being around young people because at least you have the illusion that you're not totally gone. See, so I am honored to share this speaker platform with the speakers that went before me this weekend. They were absolutely wonderful, and the recovery and their joy in sharing that recovery with us was really wonderful, and I want to thank all of you all. I went to my first Al-Anon meeting. I'm going to take my jacket off. Does anybody mind? Thank you. Believe me, taking it all off wouldn't be a treat. I went to my first Al-Anon meeting in August of 1985, which means that my Al-Anon birthday is here. And when I went to that meeting, I was a sorry, sorry human being. I was angry and bitter and scared and bewildered. My life was a total mess, and I didn't have a clue what to do about it. And you know, the worst thing of all was that I had reached a point in my life where I didn't care anymore. And I don't want to ever go back there again. And I know I don't have to. I'm grateful for so many things that the Al-Anon program has given me, but one of the things I'm most grateful for is that I am no longer that human being. I'm not angry, I'm not bitter, I'm not resentful, except occasionally. I look forward to every day with joy, and I sure wasn't like that when I went to my first Al-Anon meeting. Our program suggests that we tell what our life was like and what happened and what it's like today, and I'm going to try to do that this morning as honestly as I can, and sometimes it's more honest than others. But I have some very, very close friends in the front row here, Juanita and Bob, and when my wife and I got into the program, they kind of took us under their wing. And so when they're here, I really need to be totally honest, because they know me all the way. I was the oldest of three. I have a younger brother and a younger sister. And our dad died when I was 6 years old, and we went to live with my grandmother and grandfather in a very small house in a very poor neighborhood. This was during the Great Depression. And you know, I don't know why they call it great, because it sure as hell wasn't great. I mean, it was pretty bad. Anyway, it was during the Depression. But you know, my memory of growing up in that home and in that neighborhood and into school and everything was good, because everybody was poor. We didn't know we were poor. We just knew that everybody was the same. And so it was great. And my mother had to go to work, I lived with my grandmother and grandfather, and he was too old to work, and one other aunt lived in the house, and she worked, so there was two people in the house working, and my grandmother was too old to really supervise my brother and me, so we kind of grew up on the streets, and fortunately the streets weren't too bad where I grew up, but I learned some games that weren't totally legal, but I think they've stood me in good stead at times in my life. But when I went to high school, I went to an all-boys high school located downtown, and I found out that not everybody lived the way we did. I met some friends who lived in other parts of town, and I found out that they lived differently than us, that they had nice houses, and most of them had cars. And I bring that up in my Al-Anon talk because Even at that age in high school, I made up my mind that I was going to do whatever I had to do, and I listen to what I'm saying, whatever I had to do to live like those people did when I was older than the way we lived. And that contributed to my becoming a workaholic in my later adult life. And because I was a workaholic, it caused a lot of problems in my family, and I'm certain contributed to the need that my wife had to drink. After I got out of high school, I went in the Army during World War II, was in the Army for four and a half years, something like that. And when I got out, I announced to my family that I was going to college, and college was not a part of our family culture. High school was almost part of our family culture, but college certainly wasn't. And I remember one of my cousins, when I told him I was going to college, his very simple question was, why? You know, why? And so I was the first one in my family to graduate from college. And after I got out of college, I had a couple of jobs that were kind of no-end jobs. And I finally ended up in a job and working for a company where I, with that company or with divisions of that company, I worked until I retired. I started courting my wife a couple of years after I got out of college, and our courtship was, I guess like a lot of courtships where both of us drank pretty heavily. And after a fairly lengthy courtship, we decided to get married. And I have to tell you that ours was not a marriage made in heaven. Sue came from a very wealthy family, whose family, they owned two bourbon distilleries in Kentucky. And my family was very poor, so, you know, that's not too good a connection right off the bat there. I guess the only thing we had in common was that we both grew up in the same church. And before we got married, we talked about the fact that both of us wanted a large family. Now, you need to be careful when you talk out loud about things like that. God listens, and he sometimes gives you what you want, or what you think you want, anyway. Anyway, we got married, and 9 months after we got married, we had our first child, a girl, and when she was 3 months old, the company that I worked for offered me a promotion and a transfer to Houston, Texas, where we were going to open up a new plant. So we moved down to Texas, down to Houston, Texas, and opening up a new plant's a lot of work. And it required me to work long hours and everything else. At least that's the excuse that I used. But I did work a lot of long hours. And we started having babies on a fairly regular basis. And we ended up with 7 children in 10 years. Today I'm very grateful for that. There were a few times along the road when I wasn't too sure about that. But when those babies were small and I was doing all this lengthy hours of work and going to association meetings and all the things that I thought were necessary for me to be a success to do, live the way I wanted to live, my wife was home trying to take care of all these kids. And you mothers know what I'm talking about. She's got all these little kids around and she's cleaning them and feeding them and talking to them. And during this period of time, she tried to tell me, I'm sure many times, that she was having a problem with this, that little children are not very good conversationalists. And, you know, and that she needed more than she was getting from taking care of those kids and from what I was willing to give her. And, you know, I will regret to my dying day that I did not understand what she was trying to tell me. And so her life was rough. Was really rough. It was during this period of time that she started drinking on a regular basis and daily drinking and everything. So for the next few years, things gradually, and they were gradual, got worse because of her drinking and because of my attitude and my actions or non-actions. And you know, I talk about this part of our life together in Houston, and sometimes I forget that we had some good times during this period of time too. It wasn't all bad. We had good vacations where we had people take care of the kids, and we went on vacations with friends, and we go to New Orleans and places like this, and these were great. These were a lot of drinking, but then, you know, these we had really good times. But gradually, things got worse, as they do in a household where alcoholism starts becoming a way of life. And after we lived in Houston for 14 years, we were offered the opportunity. I was offered the opportunity and a promotion to move back to Louisville. And of course, without even talking to my wife, I said, well, of course, you know, we'll go back. And part of my thinking was that, you know, we go back to Louisville and her family's there and my family's there and things got to get better. You know, they're really going to get better. Well, all y'all know what geographical cures are like. The problem with those is that we take ourselves with us. And so when we got to Louisville, we had the same problems. We just were in a different location. Now, this was in the mid-60s when we moved back to Louisville. And of course, I had this new job and this new promotion, and it required that I work long hours and everything. So we had the same process going on. And my life's drinking continued. And along about this period of time, I, for all practical purposes, quit drinking because I didn't like the way drinking was starting to affect me. I was an incipient Al-Anon. You know, I wasn't in control when I drank, and so I kind of, for all practical purposes, cut it off. Well, in 1970, my wife went into a psychiatric hospital for the first time, ostensibly for depression, and I think there was some depression there, but while she was in there, alcoholism was mentioned for the first time, and it was suggested that she go to AA meetings, and there was no mention to me. At this time, this hospital did not have a regular treatment program, and there was no mention made to me of Al-Anon, and it wouldn't have made any difference because I certainly didn't think I needed to go to get help. If she took care of the problem, everything would be all right. For whatever reason, she went to just two or three AA meetings and decided that she didn't need to go, but she didn't drink on a regular basis for a number of years. Occasionally she would have a slip, but for the most part she didn't drink. But things didn't get any better with us because we didn't know how to make them get better. We didn't know what to do for them to get better. And so gradually, again, our relationship deteriorated. And while this was going on, the kids were growing up, and I want to talk to you a little bit about my kids and what I did to them when I get into a little bit later. In 1980, our oldest son, who was 24 years old, took his own life. He was an artist and an actor, and had been fighting demons all his teenage years and in his 20s. And like Bob said last night, I don't know anything worse that can happen than to lose a child, and particularly to lose a child to violence. And for the next 5 years, until we got into the program, we lived lives of quiet desperation. It was terrible, terrible. I felt that my wife hadn't been drinking, but she started drinking on a regular basis shortly after Mike took his own life. And I felt that I was responsible for what Mike did because I was too strict with him, and she felt like she was responsible because she was too easy for him. And you know, and neither one of us got any help, and it was just awful. There was 5 years of living hell. In 1985, my wife decided that she needed some help, and she told me that she was going into treatment, you know, and I said, yeah, okay, you know, whatever. By that time, I was at the point where I didn't care. I just didn't care. So she went into this hospital, and it's a 4-week program, and she had to spend an extra week initially just to detox and to get her in shape where she could handle the program. And I remember when she was ready to start into the regular treatment program, I was there to see her, and she handed me this paper and said, "This is the family program." And I said, "Well, what's the family program?" And she said, "Well, you're supposed to go to these meetings and everything, you know." And I said, "Well, I don't need to do that. You know, I don't have a problem." And she said, "Well, our doctor thinks it would be a good idea if you went." And I really respected the doctor, so I said, "Oh, okay, I'll go." So that family thing started. This was on a weekend. The family thing started on Tuesday, and we went all day long with lectures and films and everything. And it was good. And the woman who was the counselor said that there's a newcomers Al-Anon meeting tonight, and I would like to suggest that all of you all go. And when we were leaving, she called me back and she said, "You go." She already detected that I really needed to be there. So I tell this story. Juanita and Bob have probably heard this many times, but I went to this meeting and I walked in this room. This is in the basement of the hospital, and I stopped as soon as I got inside the door. There was nobody in there but women. 23 women. I counted them. So I'm thinking, you know, "Man, I don't belong in here. I don't know whether I ought to go in here or not." But she said, "I better go, so I guess I better go." But I knew that those people would not understand me or my problem. I just knew that. But anyway, I went in and sat down. And if you've ever been to newcomer meetings, they follow a regular agenda every week. And the first half hour or so was following this agenda. And the woman who was chairing said that, "Does anybody here have any questions?" And I said, "Yeah, I got a question." I held up my hand. I said, "My wife is upstairs, and she tells me that she's an alcoholic. And she said, it's my fault." And I said, "I think she's right." And there was a woman sitting at the table with me, across from me, and she said, "You know, I don't know you. I've never met you. I have no idea what kind of a person you are, whether you're a good husband or a good father or anything else, but I'm going to tell you something. You are not responsible if your wife is an alcoholic. And if you would like to stay after the meeting, we can talk about this a little bit." And I said, "Yeah, I'd appreciate that." So after that meeting was over, I sat at that table with four or five women, and they told me about Al-Anon and about a little bit about themselves. I always joke up here. When I left that meeting, I had a little bit of hope, and I sure didn't have any when I went in that meeting. Not a bit. Not a bit. So my wife told me that she was going to 90 meetings in 90 days when she got out of treatment, and I thought, yep, sure, you know. Well, she did. Believe me, she went to more than 90 meetings in 90 days. And you know, funny things begin to happen in our house. Not really funny, strange things begin to happen in our house. She's gone to meetings. She got a home group, a woman's group that was her home group. She got a sponsor. She's visibly getting better, physically and emotionally and mentally. And she's doing great. And I'm nuts. I'm still crazy. Only thing I'm doing is going to Al-Anon meetings. That's the only thing I'm doing right, because I still am obsessing with her disease and with her alcoholism. When she leaves to go to the grocery, I check how much time she takes, because I'm afraid she's not going to come back. You know, it was crazy. And she's getting better all the time. So things were better because she was better, but not because I was better. Yeah, I tell this story. We went to a lot of meetings together, where she would go to her AA meeting, I'd go to my Al-Anon meeting. I better get this watch out. I don't know what time I started. Well, I won't worry about it. It will just take as long as it takes. Yeah. Anyway, we would be driving to the meeting. And we live at one end of town, and we ended up going to the other end of town for most of our meetings, because a lot of the people that we met when Sue was in treatment lived in this other end of town. And so we were going to the meeting, and I'd say something, and she'd answer me calm and cool and collected, you know, and then I'd, for whatever reason, I probably didn't like what she said, and so I'd say something back, you know, and then she'd be calm. And then, you know, about the third exchange, I'm pounding the steering wheel, and my face is red, I'm screaming and hollering and everything, you know, and she's sitting over just as cool as she can be, you know. And I remember one night we get to the meeting, you know, and I get out, slam the car door, you know, and she gets out, closes it, and goes on off to the AA meeting, and I stomp into the Al-Anon room, and the lady says to me, "What's the matter with you?" I says, "My wife." Yeah. "Well, what do you mean it's your wife?" "Well, she won't do what I want her to do." Now, this is the truth. You know, she says to me, "Well, what do you want her to do?" And I thought a minute, and I said, "I don't know." You know? Now, man, that's really sick. I tell you, you know, I did not know. The first year of Al-Anon for me was like 800 days long. I mean, I really did not do well the first year in Al-Anon. I was still obsessed with my wife and with her drinking. The only thing I did right, I went to a lot of meetings. And you know what? If you go to a lot of meetings, they're going to get you. And I finally began to seep through my thick skull that Al-Anon was for me. It didn't have anything to do with my wife. It didn't have anything to do with whether she drank or didn't drink. It didn't have anything to do with what my kids were doing or what they weren't doing, or anything to do with my friends or my golf game or anything else. It had only to do with me and what kind of a human being did I want to be and how did I want to live my life. And that was the beginning for me of recovery. Now, you would think that somebody who had such a good experience at his first Al-Anon meeting and left with hope and everything would just jump in with both feet and do everything right and everything else. Well, I told you about the first year, and somewhere in the second year is where I reached this point where I realized that Al-Anon was for me. And so I better start getting with it. And so I had a sponsor that helped me with the steps. He's kind of tough, but I want to tell you my initial reaction to the steps, and I had only been in a short time, and so I already knew everything. My first reaction to the steps was I read the first step, and I said, "Well, obviously AA's need that, so I'll just, you know, we don't need that, so I'll go on to the second, and I know who was insane in my house, so I'll go on to the third." Well, I get to the third, and it starts talking about God and my relationship with God, and I thought, I better back up here a minute, you know, I'm afraid this one's going to work with me. So I had to start all over again. And I couldn't do it until I was ready. And I think when I was ready. So the first step for me was a long, long process. All my adult life I had been into control, control, control. You know, that's not true. I had been in attempted control. That's what I had been into and didn't even realize it. And so when the first step starts talking about I'm powerless over persons, places, and things, I didn't buy that a bit. I truly did not buy it. And I was not trying to be hard-headed or anything else. I just didn't buy it. I did not think I was powerless over persons, places, and things. But I went to a lot of meetings. I went to a lot of discussion meetings. Whenever I chaired a meeting where I got to check the topic, I picked the first step. And gradually, again, I began to understand that I truly was powerless over persons, places, and things. And that I had no right whatsoever to try to tell my adult children how to live their life or my wife how to run her program. I didn't have a right to do these things. And so finally I accepted I truly am powerless. That's a big step for me. Then I found out I didn't like that. I mean, who wants to be powerless? You know, I didn't like it. So I had to work through that. And I finally got to where I needed to be for me when I truly understood that being powerless was a gift, a wonderful, wonderful gift. I still sometimes forget that, but it really is a wonderful gift. So I'm ready to move on to the second step. I still think I knew who was insane in my family, you know, but sure wasn't me. I had the good fortune when I got in the program of meeting a bunch of good guys in AA, and we used to go on golf tournaments together, and I was the only Al-Anon. They took me to keep him out of jail, but we were talking one day about the second step, and one of my golfing friends says to me, "Do you know what the definition of insanity is in the big book?" And I said, "No." And he says, "Well, it's doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results." And he looked me right in the eye and he said, "Just like your golf game." You know? Well, you know, my mind's pretty simple. I can understand that. You know, I understood and I started thinking, and all my adult life I had been doing the same things over and over again expecting things to be different. And they were not. So I was able to get to the third step. I never, ever quit believing in God. I was raised in a religion, a strict religion, and I went to religious grade school and high school. So I never quit believing in God. There's no question in my mind there's a higher power, there's God. I was not in a good place with God when I got here because I felt about God the same way I felt about a lot of other things. I just didn't care. I just didn't care. Now, when I got in there, all these meetings and everything, and I'm reading, and I am beginning to understand that the program doesn't work if it's not a spiritual program. And I was not in a place for a spiritual program. And I made a good decision, and I think I made this decision because God gave me whatever I needed to make this decision. I decided I was not going to try to force myself into spirituality. I don't think that's possible. And that I was going to let the process of the steps and the process of the program, of the Al-Anon program, get me where I needed to be in my relationship with God. And it did. At some point down the road, I have no idea when I got where I needed to be, but I was very, very comfortable with turning my life and my will over to the care of God. And I am very, very comfortable with that today, with a loving God. I want to tell you all something that happened to me just a couple of months ago, and I've been in the program for 17 years. I was in church waiting for Mass to start, and I was meditating and praying and trying to a little bit. And out of nowhere, I realized I was not afraid of God anymore. Now, you know, the funny thing about that was I didn't realize before I was afraid of God. And I mean that sincerely. But I understood I am not afraid of God anymore. And that was a big step for me, a really big step for me. I am really comfortable with my higher power, with God. So I'm okay with the third step. With all of these, most of the time. But I'm okay with the third step. I worked the rest of the steps with help from a variety of people in the program. And the steps are beautiful. They are truly a way of life. When I worked the inventory steps, I began to understand what I had done to my wife when our children were young. How I had treated her, mistreated her, was unfair to her. And so I needed to make amends to her. When my kids were little, I was a pretty good father. I really helped at house, and I bathed them, and I helped them with their schoolwork, and I played with them and made their lunches every day. I'd line all these sacks up and make all their lunches and everything. So I was a pretty good father. But when my kids were teenagers, is when the bad times were in our house and I was not a good father. I was not a good father. I was angry all the time. I would not let my children do the things and talk about the things that they needed to do and talk about to mature into reasonable human beings, adults. Anything that made me uncomfortable, I would not let them talk about, and almost everything made me uncomfortable. And you know, some of my kids are still paying a price for that today. And I really, really regret that. So now I'm in the process where I need to make amends. My wife is where my wife is, and I are together, so I can make amends to her. And I believe that you make amends or that I make amends by starting off by saying, I truly am sorry for this specific thing and whatever it was. And then I truly make amends by changing, by becoming a different human being. So I had to do this with my children. Now, by this time I've got 6 adult living children, and they are all over the United States. And they're there in Florida and Connecticut and California and Texas. And I'll tell you what, if you've ever tried to make amends to your kids long distance, it's really difficult to do. A couple of my kids didn't even want to hear about it. When I would start talking to them about it, they'd say, I don't want to, just get away. I don't want to talk about that. I don't want to have anything to do with that. It made them as uncomfortable as it did me. But I persisted because I knew I had to do that. I had to do that. Now, we got in the program in 1985. In 1991, we had a family reunion in Mount Shasta, California. And all of my kids and their wives and husbands and significant others and kids got together for a week. And it was a week of love. We became a family again that week. And we were not a family before. And it was not because my wife was an alcoholic. It's because I was a crazy man. And so we became a family again. And we have had these family reunions every 2 years since then. And they are absolutely wonderful. And we've been all over. We've been in California and Cape Cod and Florida and Vermont. And next year we're going to be in the Smokies and it is a wonderful, wonderful way to keep a family together that lives scattered out all over. And you know, we're going to have the last week in June, we're going to be down in the Smokies, and I have a brand new great-granddaughter who will be a year old, and I can, 1 week to spoil her. 1 week. And I believe I can do it. Yeah. But she lives in California, so it's kind of hard to do that long distance. But I believe I can spoil her in a week, and I'm sure going to try, I can tell you that. My wife and I had 16 years of recovery together, and we had a wonderful time. We had the wherewithal to travel, and we did a lot of traveling. I love thoroughbred horse racing. We went all over the country to racetracks, to California and New York and Florida and Oklahoma City, and wherever there's a racetrack and horses running, we went. And we had a wonderful time. We made other trips too, but you know, my wife, when I met her, she never saw a horse race. And so we tried to go as much as we could, and she finally learned how to read a racing form, and I really wish she hadn't done that. Because then she would go and win money and I'd come home broke, you know. But anyway, we had this wonderful gift from God and from the program of recovery. And we were closer than we ever were before. In May of 2000, my wife was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And her illness and her death was an affirmation of the power and the love of the programs of AA and Al-Anon. She never one time said, why me? She accepted that as the will of God, and she was an inspiration to all of us in the months that she was ill before she died. I took her to her home group meeting until she couldn't walk. And then we had meetings in our home. I remember the first time that we met with the hospice people and the chaplain and the nurse, and there was 3 of them, I think, and the chaplain said to my wife, how are you all doing? And she said, well, I'm doing fine, but he's not doing so good, you know? And that's the way it goes. That's the way it works. And she did do fine all the way until the time she died. Her funeral service was, for all practical purposes, an AA meeting. And this is what she wanted, because she wanted her children to understand more about her friends and her life in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And two couples shared, and her sponsor shared, and I shared. And it was beautiful. I had a hard time for the next 14, 15 months, still do, but it was really rough. We've been married 48 years. It's a long time. And like most marriages where alcoholism is involved and recovery is involved, we followed the pattern where it was pretty good when it started, then it wasn't too good, then it was pretty bad, then it was terrible. Then in recovery, it really got better, you know, and thank God for that. Thank God for that. One of the things that I was really afraid of when my wife was sick, and I remember talking to some ladies in my home group who had lost their spouse, and I said, you know, I'm 77 years old, and I've never lived alone. I'm really afraid of living alone. I'm really afraid of that. But you know, that's been okay. That has not been a problem. I've been able to deal with that. And I know part of the reason is I have a very supportive, very loving family, and I have a very supporting, very loving family in Al-Anon and AA. I'm going to tell you a little bit about what my life is like now. And I learned a long time ago that if you are busy, you are happier. And so that's what I try to do. Now, I'm not telling you about all this stuff that I'm involved in, so you'll think, man, he's a neat dude. I am telling you this because I am different than the person who went to that first Al-Anon meeting in 1985. I go to a lot of meetings. I have a home group. I read a lot. I walk a lot. I have a computer. A friend of mine I play golf with, I got this computer about 8 years ago. He said, you're too damn old to learn how to use a computer. I said, I don't think so. You know, and I guess I'm like a lot of people my age. I learned to do on a computer what I want to do, and I really don't care about the rest of it. You know, so I do what I want to do on it, and that's great. I do volunteer work with the Al-Anon Information Service in Louisville. One thing I did want to mention, after my wife got out of treatment, I had received so much help from the family program that I volunteered in the family program at this treatment center. And for the next 10 years, I had the privilege of working with the families of patients and introducing them to Al-Anon. And it was a wonderful experience. You know, it was another gift from God. My life now is a life of joy. I said that at a meeting, and a lady came up to me afterwards, and she said, I don't understand how you can say that. She said, you lost your son, you lost your wife. But you know, that's what life is. This is a part of life. You know, I have come to understand and believe that to love and to be loved, I'm willing to pay the price of pain for losing the people that I loved and who loved me. The love is worth the pain for me. Now, I want to tell you all about something really neat that happened to me this year. Really neat. I think I told you all that I liked the thoroughbred horse racing. Well, last year, I had the opportunity to be a partner in a 2-year-old thoroughbred. Pretty good breeding. And we were all ready to run him, and late in the year, and he chipped a bone in his knee, and so he had to get operated on, and he spent the winter on a farm, and then he spent a month at one of these spas where they swim in these things all the time. I think he likes luxury. But anyway, he was scheduled to run his first race in late June at Churchill Downs, and I was there with a lot of friends in the program and part of my family, and I was on the finish line, standing on a chair, watching, and our horse, halfway down the stretch, was leading by 10 lengths. And I want to tell you, old men can get excited, believe me. I was 6 feet off of that chair, I got to tell you. It's a great feeling. It truly is a great feeling. And you know, After my wife died, I thought, you know, man, you know, my life is over. It's there's, you know, I mean, she's gone, and we were so close, and but you know, that's not the way it is. It really isn't. And I think God gave me this gift of in this horse thing because I've enjoyed it so much. My family's enjoyed it so much. And well, 3 weeks later, he ran again in another race, an allowance race down at Ellis Park, and he only won this one by 4 lengths. You know, so. But you know, 2 for 2 is pretty good for a horse. Now, in this second race, he got nailed when he came out of the gate, and he broke a small bone in his left hind foot. He still won the race. But again, he's going to take the winter off. I think he arranged his season. So he takes the winter off. You know, but fortunately, he's won enough money that he's paying for himself now. So we don't have to worry about that. I'm really looking forward to next spring when he runs again. Hopefully, when he runs again, because it's fun. It's really fun. I thank all of you all for allowing me to share with you. This has been a really wonderful convention. I love all of you. Thank you very much.